Today is June the 27th, and here are a few things that happened on this day in history. 363, the death of Roman Emperor Julian brought an end to the pagan revival. It was interesting looking back at European history because there's so much of it.
Right.
You know, you talk about, you know, this happened, then 500 years later this happened and that happened, and then you compare it to U.S. history, which is really so short. There really is a lot to look at when you go back. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the history of that with one of the famous books about that that we'll talk about, Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. We'll talk about that later in this segment as that figures into history today as well. But if you want to be a history major, study history, European history is a good place to go.
Yeah, it's really the hotbed, especially since for the past 500 years, our whole civilization has really revolved around Europe in many ways, because of the British Empire and all the different movements in there. It's just fascinating to see how nations have changed, like different ideas came about, and wars, lots of wars to study there too. But how in such a small, I think it's the smallest continent, maybe Australia is smaller. I think Europe might be the smallest continent though, but it has wars all the time. It's just really fascinating place to study.
Yeah, and world news is kind of going back there as well, especially now with the Brexit and so forth. 1693 on this day, the Lady's Mercury was published by John Dunton in London. It was the first women's magazine, first of many, and contained a question and answer column that became known as a problem page. Shouldn't it be called the answer page? I thought that was a little cynical. I thought you were going to solve your problems here. Maybe they knew when we're not going to solve these problems.
You can try your best, but
we've got no answers for you. This is beyond solving.
It has the Q&A, but the A's always blank. It just has the question there.
Yeah. The answer is always, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you on that one. So it's funny, even in this this age of really news magazines and or any type of magazine, I guess, and papers being somewhat on the decline here in the U.S. anyway, with the rise of Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. You still see question and answer columns pop up occasionally, like on the internet. It was just kind of funny to me. I don't know what type of person writes into those things. And like, right. Do they really expect some sort of an answer? Or I don't, it's always confusing to me.
Yeah. It's, because letters to the editor, like in the paper, it's kind of the same thing. It's a little different, but people send lots of those in because they want to express their opinion. So I can see the desire to, do a Q&A and respond, but most of them, though, they're not exactly usually not about big events, or like they're about small things or interpersonal stuff.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that people will put their opinion out there, or even a personal example on the internet for everyone to see. So it is something that is unexpected sometimes.
Well, I think a lot of times it seems like people are just looking for validation. You know,
right.
they'll bring up their interpersonal situation and say, my sister-in-law always did this, and you know, was it right for me to do this? And like, oh, yes, you were right. So that's, maybe we should do that. We should start a Q&A page.
That's right, yeah, for TRL.
Yeah, yeah. We'll call it the problem and solution page. We'll add one more to it. 1801 on this day, British forces defeated the French and took control of Cairo, Egypt. Egypt's been in the news lately, of course, as well. It seems like a long time ago that they had their Arab Spring, as it was called. I guess it's only been a few years back now.
About 5 years,
yeah.
I think.
But
yeah.
So much has happened since then. That nation, you know, it had been, I suppose, fairly stable for quite a few years, especially under Hosni Mubarak. And then now it's kind of popped back and forth, Muslim Brotherhood, then now the military rules, but there's... you know, it's a very evolving area over there in politics as well. 1871 on this day, the yen became the new form of currency in Japan. I've never had a yen. Have you ever had anything?
No. When I flew to the Philippines, I stopped in Taiwan. So I never got any money from what... I'm not sure what Taiwan uses. I think it's the Chinese currency. But... I did see some people, I saw other people like handling their money, and it's some pretty interesting ones I've never seen before. I didn't know what it was necessarily, but
yeah, it's interesting. When I was in Heathrow Airport, I had three forms of currency. I had dollars, I had pounds, and I had euros.
Right.
And most every place didn't care. Like, yeah, we'll take anything. So you had to kind of look at it. And the one thing I liked about euros, though, is that the coins had value to them. You know, you could have like a $2 coin or a 2 euro coin. And so, you know, with U.S. currency, your best bet is what, a pocket full of quarters?
Right, yeah.
Do they still make 50-cent pieces? Maybe. I haven't seen them in a while. But you know, I remember thinking, like, I don't have that much left. And I went in my hot pocket, and I'm like, I got like $50
here,
all in coins. I was amazed by it and very, very delighted in the coins. They tried that here with the Susan B. Anthony dollar, but it was like a quarter.
Yeah.
But it had like subtly extra edges on it. Is that still around?
I haven't seen any since I've been down here at all.
Yeah, because that didn't work, because it was always confusing. Is it a quarter or is it a dollar?
Yeah, I'm sure it's still legal tender, but they just stopped making them, and they're probably in collection cases everywhere instead.
Nothing compares to the loonie and the toonie, though.
Right.
The Canadian. The toonie is $2, right?
Yes.
And the loonie's $1. Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, the loonie just has a picture of a loon on it. So that's why they call it a loonie.
I remember it because two and toonie, it just seems to... Is that why they call it a toonie?
Yes, because it's two. It has a polar bear on it, so I don't know. It'd be like a porry or a berry, but I think toonie sounds better.
That's your best bet with currency, is put animals on it.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to be mad at the animals, but if you put people on there, then people's opinions change. Were they good leaders, bad leaders? And then you got to change the people around.
Yeah.
No one's mad at the polar bear.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on Canada's coins, it has animals and all of them, different ones, and then it has the queen on the back of all our... Then on the bills, it has different people, all the coins have the queen and an animal.
Yeah. 1924, on this day, Democrats offered Mrs. Leroy Springs for vice presidential nomination. She was the first woman considered for the job. So this is the year of the woman, I guess, right? With Hillary Clinton. So she's not quite as revolutionary as she thinks. 1924, somebody was put forward, didn't get the job, but they were at least put forward for it. 1927, on this day, the U.S. Marines adopted the English Bulldog as their mascot, which I didn't know that they had done that. 1929, on this day, scientists at Bell Laboratories in New York revealed a system for transmitting television pictures. That's a waste of time.
Yeah, no one uses that anymore.
It's one of the... I imagine there's a lot of inventions that don't quite work out, but then sometimes you hit the jackpot.
Yep.
And this was one of those. I always think it'd be interesting to go back in time and listen to like people's conversations about new technology. It's funny because actually I did. I read an old column from when the internet first started going, and it's like from 89 or something like that. And this columnist was like, this is the biggest waste of time. No one will ever use this. That went down in the hall of shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only everybody. And it'll put your paper out of business too, by the way. So
in a book I was reading on the war in Iraq, it was just talking about during one mission, the Marines, they use a UAV, so like a drone. But they wanted one with a missile on it to take out some insurgents in a building. So they had a Predator drone come, but it was flown by people in Nevada. The Marines were in Fallujah. So they were, I mean, off the size of the earth, but they were communicating to each other through email. They couldn't, it was still in the early 2000s, so they didn't have what they have today where they could just talk to each other. So emailing back and forth, they had two different video feeds, one all the way back in Nevada, and they had like pinpoint precision. So it's just amazing, the technology, what it can do.
Yeah, for sure. 1950, on this day, 2 days after North Korea invaded South Korea, U.S. President Truman ordered the Air Force and Navy into the Korean conflict. The United Nations Security Council had asked for member nations to help South Korea repel an invasion from the North. That was in 1950.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because it shows, I think it's the only time where the U.N. actually fought a war, where it wasn't peacekeeping, wasn't holding action. They actually fought a war led by the United States. And I think, too, what I think a lot of people don't know about the Korean War is it was started by Stalin. China helped when North Korea was losing because they didn't want U.S. pushing into their nation. But it was started by Stalin. The Soviet Union was the main ally of North Korea. It wasn't even China at the time. So that's how it got started. And then when Stalin died, the Soviet Union didn't care as much. But the Soviet Union is the one that started the nuclear program, gave them money, research, reactors, all that throughout the Cold War. So it is an interesting part of history I didn't know about. But yeah, it was Stalin who started everything.
Yeah, speaking of the UN, there's a story today for all those that are interested. There was a bunch of UN vehicles rolling down an interstate in, I forget what state it was, somewhere out in the East Coast, and somebody took a picture of it. They're like on the back of a truck. They're being transported somewhere.
Yeah.
And they posted it to Facebook, and they said, what's going on with all these UN vehicles? So I don't know. Don't know where they're going.
Yeah.
Bulletproof glass. Those are some utilitarian vehicles.
Yeah, probably to the next Trump rally.
I don't know what they're doing. But anyways, people get kind of anxious, I guess, when they see those things. But it just highlights that everybody's a journalist today.
Right.
And somebody sees something, they take a picture of it. All of a sudden, it's up on the internet everywhere. And then people, of course, go back and forth about what they think that all means. But anyway, that's interesting. We're not used to seeing UN vehicles in the U.S., I guess.
Right. I think they're produced here. So my guess is a company produced them. They're sending them to get shipped and they were on the highway. That's my guess.
Yeah, that was one of the thoughts somebody had. But anyway, people like to go back and forth on that. it can be interesting. Here's one we're going to talk about just a little bit more today. We alluded to a little bit earlier. 1787 on this day, Edward Gibbon completed The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It was published the following May. It's interesting that book was written so long ago. It's very up to date. It's very essential reading even for now, especially for now. And yet it was written back in 1787.
Yeah, this is one of the great English classics. It is something that a lot of historians see as current reading for current events because it's so well written and it does highlight the historical processes that we're living through today. And Edward Gibbon, he was a member of Parliament and a historian, obviously. And this book, it really was his life. This was the major thing he wrote, 6 volumes. It was the first modern history where he quoted the original sources. Just well-documented, great flowing language. A lot of people, historians, read it to learn how to write and how to research history. Just one of the best written histories, I think, ever. Just original. Keeps it interesting. He combines narratives with factual research in a way where it really binds everything together. And you get this rich tapestry of history, really. It's not just, I think a lot of people, when they think of history, it's like a textbook where it's dates and maybe some boring facts, but Edward Gibbon, though, he really set the benchmark, I think, to what historians try to attain with their works. But this one's more, I think, very important, though, because he lived, this was written right during the American Revolution when Great Britain was being challenged, and he wrote about Rome because he traveled to Rome. He saw the ruins, he saw the Colosseum, he saw the ruins, and he became fascinated at how Rome came to power and how they lost everything. And he was thinking about even Britain. They were a small island and suddenly they were gaining power and it looked like they were on the decline because of the American Revolution. So he wrote the book with the perspective of looking at Roman history and to apply it to modern times on what's going wrong with Britain, what's going wrong with any empire. So it's really the story of how any empire rise and falls. So it's a really fascinating history and has a lot of great points on why nations decline and fall apart and their lessons that are even more relevant today, because I think with America and Britain, we're so far along, even more than when he was alive, that we're seeing those lessons play out.
Do you have any sense of how modern U.S. historians feel about that piece? And the reason I ask that is because some of what's highlighted in there is moral decline. And now some would argue that, well, the morals are better than they've ever been. but in this country. But I think the hard, cold reality, if people are willing to look at it, is that there is a real slide there, a moral slide. And so I just wonder how they would be able to reconcile that history of seeing a nation go that direction morally and then seeing them be destroyed, looking at what's happening in the United States today.
Right. I think a lot of realist historians are those more conservative, because Gibbon was more conservative in his bias when he wrote the book. They do see it as a vital text to understanding history, because Gibbon wrote the book on the basis that human nature does not change, and that, in fact, civilizations decline. As the older they get, they don't improve, they actually decline. And so human organizations always end in violence. That's the conclusion of the book. That's one of his conclusions. So for a lot of liberals, they don't like that, because it goes exactly against the historical narrative they believe is true. But in his book, just to prove this point, he has two lists in it. One is the 8 points of why Rome fell. And the first point is a decline in morals and values. And he goes through how there is the violence and the rampant sex and everything. The 32,000 prostitutes in Rome at their peak, like just in Rome, one city. And
that's like a city in
exactly.
And of itself. Yeah.
Yeah. So just showing the that's this one point on why they fell. And then he had another set, the 5 marks of Roman decaying culture. And I'll just list these quickly, because you would think I'm talking about America. And these are his 5 points. First one, concern with displaying affluence instead of building wealth. Number two, obsession with sex and perversions of sex. Number three, art becomes freakish and sensationalistic instead of creative and original. Four, widening disparity between very rich and very poor. And number five, increased demand to live off the state.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's just amazing that, as you mentioned, this is what a lot of liberals actually want. But he points through you can't dispute the facts that when you look at the history of Rome, it was a glorious empire, but started decaying from within. And he points out all these different points I mentioned, but he quotes people who were living at the time and shows how it didn't work, and that Rome was conquered by the Germans, the Germanic tribes, and it ceased to exist, and that we've seen it revive time and time again. That's one thing he actually does get wrong in it, that the Roman Empire didn't actually die. It's been revived several times, the Holy Roman Empire. So that part he didn't understand, obviously, but the principles are still the same. And I think to understand history, and especially a great empire, a great nation like America, where it's heading, I don't think you can read a better book on the lessons of history.
Yeah, and there's less of an emphasis on history in a lot of universities today, but you can understand why, because the history flies in the face of a lot of the ideology that's taught. You can't very well teach some of the ideologies that they have there, or spread those around, and then go have a class where you look at what happened when people did that last time.
Right.
That would be conflicting. That would be a problem.
Yeah.
And so it is just always so interesting, because what's always touted is a free society. But if you've ever sat in a university classroom, there's not a lot of freedom there. You're free to listen to what they're telling you, but you're not free to have a different opinion.
Right.
As opposed to like what they're pushing at you directly. And but really, if truth is the ultimate objective, then there should be a pretty free exchange and a look at history. But again, how are you going to teach that in one class and then ship somebody off to another class where they teach something completely opposite?
Right. Yeah. I think studying things like this or discussing them really shows that, in a sense, some universities or levels of education are more like you're paying to be indoctrinated rather than you're learning truth, or you're trying to figure out like what you like, what's true, because each person has to prove it for themselves, what's true and what's not. But people don't have that opportunity. And actually, Gibbon when he wrote the book, it was very controversial. He was, a lot of people thought it was terrible. He got chided for it, but has proven the test of time over almost 300 years, and we're still reading it today. So that's because he proved it. He studied it. He based his life around trying to figure out what was the right perspective to have on it. I mean, you can disagree with his bias and everything in it, but it is impressive work, and it does highlight some vital truths about history.
And you can still go visit the ruins today.
Yes.
They're still ruins.
Yes.
They didn't come back to life, yeah. Yeah, very interesting. 1787, Edward Gibbon completed The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. You can find that. It's out there in bookstores or online. You can read that if you'd like to. Pretty interesting read. Some good history there. The Key of David program is coming up here in just a bit on KPCG and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure you listen for those. That'll do it for us on Trumpet Radio Live today on this Monday. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online, kpcg.fm.